Poetry on the Radio, poetry in and around the ACT. Today, the second of two installments of our conversation with Theodore L., plus the Rhyming Bugle, poetry news and events around the region. For ArtSound FM Community Radio, I'm Peter Searles. As we heard last week, Theodore L. studied literature and modern languages at the University of Sydney and earned a PhD in 2010 based on his research in Florence into some little-known Italian anti-fascist writers. That led to his 2015 study of them, A Voice in the Fire. While he and his wife were in Beirut, Lebanon, where she was on a diplomatic posting, they survived the massive port explosion of August 2020. After they had settled back in Canberra, where he is an honorary lecturer in literature at the Australian National University, his essay about that event, Facades of Lebanon, won the prestigious 2021 Caliber Essay Prize. We'll hear about that experience today. Theodore L.'s 2022 collection from Recent Work Press, Beginning in Sight, was co-winner of the 2022 Anne Elder Award for a first poetry collection. That book begins with an invocation, an invitation. Ironically, it's about not inviting a visitor in during a time of emergency.
Now, I would have you in. That would be a help. But who knows how long the roads will still be clear. So head home, I said, and give them all my love. That was through the screen door, and the mesh was pressed to the frame a bit as we talked. The first gusts of a front. And then I might have raised the latch. What stopped me was the new way we held our eyes, our seeing right through as the mesh went hard, then slack. For all that was said, we saw where we would be. So head home, I said, and give them all my love. For a while I watched the street, looked out for cars, then closed up. On the porch, dry leaves flit in rings. Too soon for dusk. Clouds that hide the sun still shift and leave it. Shine left in the trees. Things might keep in a fit state yet, though that makes for no news. The lamps may not come on. What will come for us is thought. We are young. It is the best of us. The last friend to take its leave. Head home, I said, and give them all my love.
Kimberly K. Williams asked him about the opening poem.
I see this first poem as an invitation. You're going to be bringing us these small moments throughout all these poems. And in a way, it's a poem about an ending. Head home, but at the same time, it's the beginning. And I see it very much as a, you know, come in.
It's interesting you should say that, because yes, it is about not letting someone in and telling them to go home. And it's as though something big is brewing, something big, something nasty, something menacing. And the poem is essentially about saying, oh, I'll be all right, just go. Now, for context, this was one of the ones I wrote in Lebanon. It was also one of the last before I sort of declared the book finished. It was written during lockdown. Now, my wife and I were living in Lebanon and had been, by the time I wrote this, we'd been there for about a bit more than 18 months. And we'd seen the country descend into revolution, which was then repressed violently. Then COVID and lockdown came. And we were there for the 2020 Black Summer bushfires, which were happening here in Australia. And we were just watching that in horror from a distance and hearing about all that was going on from family. I mean, a township where my parents spent a lot of time was cut off against the coast by fire. As was fortunate, nothing happened to the town itself, but you know, there was real danger. And this was another one of those ones that came upon me as a sense of atmosphere and of a situation that then coalesced down into words. I wrote it almost automatically in the space of a day or two. And the idea of someone, of two people, two neighbors, two friends, I don't know who they are, facing some sort of hideous or menacing or strange and unknown force bearing down on them, whether it's a bushfire or a virus and lockdown or something, I thought, what would one of them say to the other? You're not allowed to come in. So obviously the lockdown is in play here somehow. What would one of them say to the other? Well, he'd say something to the effect of, no, I'll be all right, just go. And I, the phrase came to me, head home, give them all my love. It's casual. It seems casual, but it is. When that came to me, I realized what weight is in that. And the other thing that came to me was, they're all monosyllables. What if I write the whole poem in monosyllables? There is only one polysyllabic word in this poem. It's extremely important. Seeing. Which also has an onomatopoeic effect, slightly. This is something I take from one of those Italian poets, Montale. Montale could be a master of onomatopoeia, as Robert Gray is, as Les Murray is, and often transtermer in translation. Montale had this gift for picking a certain word which has extreme thematic importance, but also has a sort of laser-like effect. And so I just treated the poem almost like a short story. Let's put ourselves in the position of a narrator. Let's put ourselves in the position of one of these people on either side of a door. Let's make it the one who's being left, but who's telling the other person to leave them. And as it went, it's almost a dramatic monologue. As it went, more and more little hints of context made themselves known to me. Now, I would have you in. That would be a help. But who knows how long the roads will still be clear. So head home, I said, and give them all my love. That was through the screen door, and the mesh was pressed to the frame a bit as we talked. The first gusts of a front. And then I might have raised the latch. What stopped me was the new way we held our eyes, our seeing right through, as the mesh went hard, then slack. For all that was said, we saw where we would be. So head home, I said, and give them all my love. For a while I watched the street, looked out for cars, then closed up. On the porch, dry leaves flit in rings. Too soon for dusk. Clouds that hide the sun still shift and leave it. Shine left in the trees. Things might keep in a fit state yet, though that makes for no news. The lamps may not come on. What will come for us is thought. We are young. It is the best of us. The last friend to take its leave. Head home, I said, and give them all my love.
The poem contains something which I think is, typifies your work in general, is that it moves from specific scenes or things that you see or things that happened, but slides to another register of what it might mean.
Yes, that is sometimes in these poems, it's a bit more studied. I might pause in a poem and think to myself, right, well, what is this really getting at, and make some notes about it and try and work them in. In this case, it was not deliberate at all. I was particularly in the last couple of verses there, describing details of, you know, dusk, clouds moving. And then I thought, well, in Lebanon, quite literally, the lamps might not come on. The nation was failing. There was a genuine sense of, well, this really could be it. You know, we could all go up in flames. And then it just occurred to me, well, what happens when the lights go out? There's nothing left. Well, what's left is you. What's left is in your head. And right up to the point of whatever strange force is coming for you hits you, that's what you have. Well, in the end, I would hope the book makes that an encouraging thought. That, yes, suddenly the poem slipped into a larger dimension, I suppose.
Part of what we're talking about there is you were in Lebanon and the situation was dire, but an event occurred. Your experience in Lebanon is described in an award-winning essay that you wrote for the Australian Book Review about the explosion that you lived through.
Yes, I wrote the poem I've just read, I wrote before the explosion, it's true, but after the revolution and the failure of this revolution and during lockdown. The explosion was still waiting in the wings and it burst in on us. In the essay I said it entered without knocking. It was a Titanic event. If ever you've seen a film with a nuclear explosion in it, you know, a war film or something, that's what it felt like. That's what we thought it might have been for a short while there. It was so enormous. The sound of it also, if you've seen the movie Oppenheimer, when they detonate the bomb in the desert at the Trinity test site, there's a moment, it happens in complete silence because it's a few miles away, and only after a long pause does the sound hit you. That sound, I don't know how they did it, with what digital wizardry, that was the sound of Beirut. I mean, not literally. I don't think they used a recording. No, I think they created it. They engineered it. But it was exactly the same. My wife and I were inside that sound, in reality, with the house crashing and, you know, just, it was like being hit by a train. Getting to grips with these experiences, that is my instinct. My instinct is to interpret. And this is why I wanted and tried so hard for many years to be an academic, which I still am. ANU has been very good to me, but it's not my job. It's not my paid job.
That raises the question of what you might do with that experience in Lebanon. You're left with this sort of store of experience that is so huge.
Well, I have written a book about Lebanon now, which will be published this year, this August. It's a memoir. It's called Lebanon Days. It is the story from beginning to end of the time that I spent in Lebanon, which came to about 2 years. Starts with me arriving, ends with, because my wife was already there. She'd been there for 6 months. Starts with me arriving, ends with us leaving. And between those two events, it just describes our lives, what we saw, and what we experienced, including the explosion. So parts of the essay I reused parts of the essay in the book, word for word, but it's 20 times longer than that and talks about vastly more detail. There is actually no literal spoken connection between Beginning in Sight and Lebanon Days. They don't really cross over at all, but they are companions. By the time we left Lebanon, I had this book. And the amazing thing for me is that, we survived by the skin of our teeth. This book was also a survivor. It was the only thing, it was the only piece of work of mine to survive the explosion because it was on a hard drive. It was saved. My laptop was damaged and frozen, and my physical notes were destroyed. They weren't burned. It wasn't a fiery explosion, but they were torn to shreds or blown out the window, never to be found again. So Beginning in Sight was saved on a hard drive in a drawer. And so it lived through it. And my little notebook that I carried everywhere also survived because it was blown out the window with a lot of other things from my desk, but it fell into the window box. And I found it on the last day when we were, I think it was the last day, but I found it very late in the piece when we were clearing out what we could salvage. And I'd all but given up hope of finding it.
Oh, wow.
But there it was. It was under a stanchion. It was under a sort of piece of steel and all this rubble. And I managed to find it.
As I'm listening to everything you're saying, there's this idea. The metaphor is repeated, right, in the Repetend, head home. And home is, you know, in this case, the physical act of turning the page and launching into the poems. For me, for somebody who's lived a lot of different places, for me, words are my home. Poetry's my home.
Yes.
And that's, I think, how I see this as an invocation.
Yes, yes. I've got shivers down my spine, Kimberly, because you've hit the nail on the head. That is exactly right. It works on two levels, because in a more sort of literal sense, a lot of the poems are about places I've either lived in or know very well and feel at home in. So Sydney figures a great deal. The New South Wales, the rural areas, particularly the Hunter, which is where a lot of my... I have some deep childhood memories. And also the Canberra region. So there's a sense of grounding in home places. But also, yes, that poem is an invocation to dive into poetry and language as home. Mm. There are a couple of poems here which, in my mind, are set in Lebanon, but which are not explicitly so. And that's deliberate because, it would have been a bit odd for a reader to come upon a poem, oh, we've been reading about the Hunter Valley and suddenly we're in Lebanon. So I left a mention of Lebanon out of them. The poems could be set wherever a reader imagines them to be set. Tenebrae is one of those. I was writing Tenebrae in reference to Lebanon in my own mind, but also I thought, well, let's leave it without a specific context so that someone in Australia, for example, could imagine this in their own context. But now this is, in my mind, this is a description, an evocation of Beirut after the failed revolution and in lockdown, where churches, particularly Maronite Catholic churches, are very much a feature. Tenebrae. Nightfall on the sill. Trinkets. Hardened dust. Sky in the gaps of a broken comb. The medley of towers, antennae. The city, a queue for dinner at a swish place, or a catwalk. Thoughts of not doing an evening by halves, not dress circles or crystal filled in series, only forgetting the rule of doubt for hours, leaving morning till morning, whole vacancies. This sill, monogrammed by wine rims. A living. Rest from studying the pavement in silent lines, from the cold communion, aid. Frail-voiced nuns chant responses from behind gilt fences through the workless days. They reach some in the street, who look in, down a ribcage of coloured light, high rafters, canopy, a keyhole vision of dusk between towers, that toothed horizon, a light that breaks our outline, hides our numbers. There are other much lighter poems, much gladder ones. The next one, having had the invocation at the start of the book, the first sort of poem where we get on the front foot in the book is called Mooring, and it is dedicated to Robert Gray and his partner Dee Jones. This was written entirely in Lebanon, out of nowhere. Just thinking back on places I know, specifically Broken Bay in New South Wales. Mooring. An estuary no road has reached. Staked mangrove flats, forest shelved high above the seagrass. On surfaces wavering and firm, a brightness fit to crack. Beneath still keels, green stirrings. Late lamplight in coves, where at some noons white sails slide in or away. Slow skirmishing dragonflies. Brief haven, dwindling retreats, vacant intermittent houses crouched over the shallows, slant timber, wavelets at doorsills, unfamiliar craft laying creels in the channels, striped shoals hurry to gaps among the mudbanks where the heron is poling. In stillness, we suspect the present of outwitting us, editing matters in our absence. The upriver wind carries voices after every wake. If they too came only in rare crossings, low hearsay, as when thunder out to sea sends tremors through the ebb-tide pools, then we might overhear the teeming that has weighed this air past remembering, that drifts among the stilts of creaking floors. No, as though blind, an old touch at the elbow. Dive through the sun's clutches from grey pier boards into cool ciphers. Fluent silence, occlusion of echoes. Hours when not a vessel moves, when the sky infiltrates standing water, screens cloud abysses on the inlet. Then we might take peace unawares, then hide it among these remnants, these appearances.
One of the things that I guess is really obvious about your poetry is that it requires some sort of explication, or at least sitting with it, almost like you need to infuse yourself in the words because they don't provide the obvious sense of what you're saying.
I think that's fair, yes. It's not as if I'm sort of smirking, thinking, well, I'm not going to let you get away with it that easily. That's not the point. I do drive at having a poem happen to you. Happen. I want the poem to happen to a reader, not necessarily make sense immediately. I would hope that it does sort of make sense if you sit with it and sleep with it. But really what I'm after is the effect of language before the meaning. Yeah. I'm almost obsessive in my use of the thesaurus to try and find words that carry a meaning, yes, but that also sound right and feel right in context. And it's often verbs, actually. Verbs, they can have a wonderful effect, like when the sky infiltrates standing water. I mean, that's pure metaphor. Sky can't possibly do that, but it's the sense of looking at water and seeing the sky reflected on it and through it. And to me, the word infiltrates is the right one to use because it onomatopoeically conveys the sound and the sensation of standing water. Mm. The F, the sound of the syllable fill is delightful to me. And I love the... I want to convey the sound and almost a physical effect before any cognitive meaning.
That actually raises a point that technically that the metaphor is embedded. It's not made explicit. You don't say that something is like something.
Yes, that's right. It's the difference between inhabiting a metaphor and almost deploying a simile. Something is as beautiful as, or something is like something else. And this is poets of all descriptions have trodden that path and walked both sides of the line. Robert Gray, who is an inspiration to me and also I'm glad to say a friend, is very much on the side of simile because he wants to put some distance between the image and the speaker of the poem, whereas someone like Les Murray, who I mean, I also admire greatly, inhabits metaphor. His poems just overwhelmingly happen to you, and you have to sit with them for a while to cogitate and understand quite what's taking place. I am somewhere in the middle, I think, because there are straightforward similes in a poem called Turning Circle. The main character compares an idea of his profession. He says, he thinks his profession is like those coins turned up by workmen unearthing a mains. The character is an historian, and he thinks that the career of history is like those coins being dug up. So that's a straightforward simile. I'm not, so I have it both ways.
Yeah. Well, I guess the overall sense, though, is that these are poems that you do have to sit with. It's very helpful to have you read them yourself. This should be an audiobook, perhaps, as well.
As I said before, I was trying to get beyond the melancholy, eventually, in writing these shorter, denser poems. This is another one that was written in Lebanon, and this was one where I felt... this is the one where I felt, all right, I've made it now. I've got away from the old cloying memories and feelings. This is fresh. The way forward, this is the evening of the balance. And it's called Sunshower. Late in the year, a lifted blind let in reunions, light beating on the leaves. A likeness had come over the days to forerunners peopled with smaller shadows, as though old friends were coming home to bargain for extensions on the past, make disclosures from before the crowding out of life. Hesitant warmth in light of words that left their handprints on the mirror. Pressure to tread lightly on the grass spears, barefoot even. There was recovery in the turf, though a soul could best what the drought had not. Then the clouds, encountering errors, thinned away. Not the peace we were preparing for, though perhaps a truce with silence. A noon for me, a keepsake.
Today we've heard the second of two installments of our conversation with Canberra-based poet Theodore L. His 2022 collection is Beginning in Sight from Recent Work Press. Next week, our visitor will be K.A. Nelson. For Artsound FM's Poetry on the Radio, I'm Peter Searles.
The Rhyming Bugle. The 2024 ACT Book of the Year Award is open for nominations. It has a prize of $10,000 for the winner, $2,000 for any highly commended book, and $1,000 for each shortlisted book. Nominations close at 5 p.m. on Thursday, March 28, via the online Arts ACT Grants portal. Applications are invited for the 4th University of Tasmania Hedberg Writer in Residence program. The residency is open to all established writers in any field or genre resident in Australia. The successful writer receives a $20,000 stipend, plus self-contained accommodation in the heart of Hobart, to spend 3 months writing from an office on the University of Tasmania's Sandy Bay campus and engaging with Tasmanian writers. Applications close on March 31, and the residency will be undertaken from August 11 to October 31. Apply online via the University of Tasmania website. Search for Hedberg Writer in Residence Program. On March 25 at Smith's Alternative in Civic, That Poetry Thing presents Angie Contini and Maya Brown. Sydney-based Angie Contini is an interdisciplinary artist, musician and writer and curator of The Salons, who publishes her essays, artworks and poems via open access journals and anthologies. Her most recent projects include the poetry and hand-cut collage piece Fierce, Flying Islands 2023, and the photographic philosophy essay Becomings, Gothic Nature Journal 2023. Maya Brown, who is on exchange at the ANU, is an alumna of Hive Young Writers based in Yorkshire, England, and is a member of the Writing Squad. She was shortlisted for the 2022 New Poets Prize. Her multimedia works include pieces about strange creatures she finds outside. Poetry on the Radio is produced weekly in the studios of Artsound FM in Canberra on unceded traditional land. Hosts Kimberly K. Williams and Peter Searles create the program with producer Peter Monaghan. Poetry on the Radio is heard each Sunday at 4:30 p.m. and again at 10:30 p.m. on Mondays. Find out more on the Poetry on the Radio page under the Programs tab at artsound.fm. Our theme is an imagining of an ancient Greek hymn to the muse Calliope, performed by the Atrium Musica de Madrid.